You're listening to STB Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to STP Radio. I'm Mike Lyles, and I'll be your host for this episode. This interview today is going to be different than our recent interviews with the STP Con conference speakers. Today, we're going to talk about a special software test professionals event. Yes, I'm talking about our upcoming rapid software testing class, which is going to be May the 9th through the 11th in Charlotte, North Carolina, very close to my home. The instructor for this class is none other than James Bach himself. So let's meet our very special guest. Welcome to STP Radio, James.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I'd like to start with a quick introduction. Just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into testing and what you're currently doing.
I've been testing for a long time. Since 1987, when Apple hired me to be a test manager. And before that, I was doing video games. And before that, I was a high school dropout. So I did those things. So I've been testing a long time. I enjoy programming, but I really enjoy problem solving, especially of complicated puzzles. And so I get that in the way that I do testing. I turn testing into a detective story. I'm searching for those bugs that I believe are there, but I can't yet see. And it's tremendously exciting to me.
Awesome. And I think that, as long as I've known about testing, I've known about you, and I think your name is kind of synonymous with testing, and it's interesting to hear that you were working at Apple back when Apple probably wasn't as big as they are right now.
Well, there were 12,000 employees when I worked there. I heard recently there's 70,000 now, something like that. So it's a lot bigger than it used to be, that's for sure.
And I know that your first travel you ever did by yourself was to attend Apple Fest in Boston when you were 15. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. That was also the first time anyone offered me drugs. So mamas, don't let your babies get on a Greyhound bus by themselves to go to Boston, I guess. My mother, I didn't have any money, so my mother arranged for some friend of a friend whose child was going to MIT to let me sleep in an MIT fraternity house. Wow. Which I did, and I thought that was going to be so cool because when I was 15, I was really into intellectual conversation of any kind that I could get. And I thought, I'm going to go to MIT and I'm going to talk with all these MIT kids who were all obviously 5 years older than me. And it'd be great. I'm going to have all these great conversations. And there was no conversations. They were drunk and apparently high. And otherwise, they were fun-loving kids that I have no use for because I'm not really into parties. I like to solve problems. When I was that age, I just felt so let down because I idolized MIT. I really wanted to go to MIT.
Right. And I know a lot of people that are.
So I found the whole experience actually rather depressing. I didn't end up doing any drugs. I went home again.
Well, I think that was probably one of the first times you realized you're going to be different. You're going to be different than the norm. I realized that about you right from the start when I learned who you were and what you do. Had a great respect for being different. And I think that was connecting you with Apple was and Apple being different. You know, they always think different. They start with why. They have a reason why they're doing what they're doing. And it's what differentiates them from the other computer makers. And I think that you have a why within you that, you know, why do I want to do testing this way? And I know that everybody that knows you now relates you to context-driven testing and that process. So when did you realize that you needed to change the way we plan and execute our testing?
Well, it was when I was reading testing textbooks at Apple, because that's the first thing I did, is I thought, I better learn how to test. So I got every testing book that I could find at the Apple corporate library, and then I went down to the technical bookstores in San Jose and bought every testing book I could find. I subscribed to every journal that I could subscribe to. Apple Computer at that time had this now illegal service that they provided that was wonderful, which is that the Apple Library would send around the tables of contents of like 200 journals to anyone who wanted to see them. And you would circle the papers that you wanted and they would just photocopy them and send them to you. And that turns out to be terrible copyright violation, and they were sued and they had to stop. But and before they stopped, I got this huge pile. I just virtually subscribed to every technical journal, every scientific journal, and I amassed this huge pile of science papers on any subject even vaguely related to testing. And I resolved to really learn how to do it. And for some reason, unlike most people, I didn't think that the way to learn how to do it was to watch anyone else do it or to talk to anyone else who might have more experience than me. Right. There were 400 people in the building I worked in, all of whom were testers. And I didn't feel like it, you know, I guess I tried early on to ask them about testing. And what I found is that people gave me silly answers. I mean, I had no experience as a tester, but I could still tell that their answers didn't have any content. I'll give you an example. Somebody told me that testers think differently. They told me that. They said, testers think in a special way. They think like testers. And I said, oh, that sounds cool. What is different about the way testers think? And the guy, I recall, said something like, well, you know, it's just different. It's just, we try to break stuff, he said. And that didn't make any sense to me. I thought, come on. That's not an answer. That's you're just waving your hands in the air and speaking in tongues. It does not make sense. So I think I quickly said, well, I'm going to not find the answer by talking to these jackasses. I have to go to the professors to find out about testing. So then I was reading all these papers and books. And I tried to do the stuff that the books were saying you were supposed to do, and it doesn't work. And, you know, a couple of years later, I realized why. And that's because the people who write that stuff don't do testing. So I really do need to deal with people who have experience. But the problem is the people who have experience often cannot explain anything about what they're doing. They don't understand what they're doing, even though they're doing it. And this took me just many years to sort out, but real early on, I realized that I was all alone. I just had to figure it out for myself. I had to reinvent testing for myself so that I could explain it. And I embarked on that process, and a few years into it, a couple years into it, I started speaking. And that helped, and I was trying to teach people even when I didn't really know very much myself, and that helped. I just immediately turned toward methodology, and the main reason for that is I really wanted to feel like I knew what I was doing, and I don't understand people who are willing to do a job, and they can't explain why they're good at it or how to do it. I always feel empty inside if I have that sense about things. And I didn't want to feel empty about my work. So I guess I was pushed to think differently about it by the fact that I didn't want to be a fraud and I wasn't getting the right help from other people who could explain testing to me. So, and the books weren't really helping either. So that just, the only thing left is to figure it out for myself, put it into my own words. And that led me to reject a lot of things that even today people take as normal in testing. I was arguing against them 25 years ago, and I was right 25 years ago. But, you know, later generations of testers are still fed the same nonsense, still raised on the same lies that were being, people were trying to feed to me way back then.
This is so good. I look back and I found some of my archives from 10, 15 years ago when I was in testing early on, and how that I perceived testing, how I should do testing, and how I should set it up. And I remember thinking back then, even, this isn't going the way I want it to go. This doesn't feel right, you know, and there's a feel to that. And I think when I look at what I've learned along the way, meeting so many great people at conferences, getting to meet you multiple times, hear your story, learn your story, I get to take that back to my organization and I get to introduce it to them. And I get to say to them, this is why you need to do this. And I think it's really eye-opening. And I think, to your point, I think a lot of people realize I can be happy in my job because I'm doing what I think is right when they're doing the right things.
Yeah, and let me be clear. When I say I reinvented testing, my attitude isn't that I reinvented testing. Now I know how to do it right. Now all future generations must shut up and follow my instructions. I don't do it that way. What I do is what I wish someone had done with me, which is I try to lead people through their own process of discovery so that they can reinvent testing for themselves, but they will reinvent it much faster than I did. I'm trying to facilitate self-education when I teach testing because I know that's so much more effective than to say, repeat after me. You know, these are the five tenets of testing and you must memorize them. That's not how I learn. I learn by struggling with problems and then talking about them with my friends and my advisors. And so I try to be a friend and advisor to other people to help them digest the experiences that they have. And I also suggest experiences for people to have. But I'm not an authoritarian who has the attitude that I learned it. Now you just have to copy me. And I think it would be terrible for our craft if we take that that attitude. So I'm trying to keep it open and free. That's why I'm against certification, because it's closing down the craft. It's threatening the ability of people to learn for themselves.
Right. Agreed. Well, and I think you've led, you broke out, you made a difference. You said, here's how we should do things. And you got people to follow you with that. And I think leading is not pulling people. It's showing your vision, showing what you've done and how it's been successful for you and making others feel that they should join in and be part of that. I know you led a breakout from summer camp when you were 12. So what was that about?
Well, I went to hunter training camp in Vermont, which is necessary if you want to be a hunter below a certain age. I guess you have to go to hunter training. And so I wanted to be a hunter. And I became a hunter in Vermont. I never did actually kill anything. And I'm now happy that I never killed anything. At the time, I was a little bummed out. But now I'm glad that no animal had to die just to help me grow up or something. So I went to hunter training camp, but the thing is that there were a lot of kids there from bigger towns than I was from. Yeah, there are a couple of cities in Vermont. we used to learn in Vermont that there were nine cities in Vermont. We had to memorize the names of the nine cities that were in Vermont. So anyway, there was a little gang of kids that were from the big city, and they were bullying everyone else. And so I was constantly on my guard, constantly getting into fights or about to get into fights. So I ran off into the woods quite a lot and just hung out in the woods and just disappeared, and then would wander back into the camp. But then one night, somebody in another cabin, a group of kids were in trouble or something, and they were being forced to do push-ups. And we were muttering about it over in my cabin because we heard them out there, and we thought that the camp counselors were being unfair. So I just had this idea, I'm just going to leave. I'm just going to walk into the woods in the middle of the night and just say no to all this. So I did. I just said, I'm out of here. So I walked out, and I'm standing in the woods, not really knowing what I'm going to do next. And another one of the kids from my cabin joined me. He saw me going. So he said, I'm going to go too. And then a few more came. And I realized that I was a ringleader at this point. It was great. So then we decided we were going to break into the kitchen building and try to get some food. So to have a late night snack, you know. So we, of course, nothing's locked. So break into is sort of not really the right term. But we weren't supposed to be there. So I guess we were breaking. So we went in there, and we couldn't find any food because they'd taken all the food away. And we were hanging out there, and one of the camp counselors came because they were now searching for us because I guess they heard that we were gone. And this counselor came, and he was so nice to us. He treated us with respect. He talked to us. I learned a lot from that experience. I learned what I now know is an important part of being an adult. But sometimes it's very important to just do what you think is right, even if a lot of other people are going to be really annoyed by that. And sometimes if you do that and people see you do that, they will join you because they will say, you know, I feel the same way. I wasn't going to take action, but now that I see he's taking action, I am going to follow. I am going to be part of that. And as an adult, I use that tactic. I use that dynamic. I exploit that dynamic in the way that I live and in the way that I work. I think it's a very fundamental part of human society. It's what leadership is all about, is to have a belief system, a moral compass, and to be concerned about what other people think. I'm definitely concerned about what other people think and what other people feel. Yes. But I won't be dominated by that. I almost said I won't be controlled by that, but I think I will allow myself to be controlled by other people's feelings sometimes. But I think the right word is dominated. And what I was doing when I was a little kid there was learning how to not be dominated, how to respond to attempts to not to convince me, not to get along with me, you know, not to, I mean, there's lots of things that are reasonable that other people do to try to influence other people. It was the being bullied, being dominated part that was right. The problem for me. I felt like I was in prison in that summer camp. I was absolutely miserable. And that made a big impact on me. I didn't want to ever go to prison ever again. And I really wanted to be an adult when I was a kid. And I became an adult as fast as I possibly could.
Well, I think you mentioned something there. There's a great YouTube video, and I'm sure you've seen it. It's been watched a million times, of Start a Movement. And there's one guy out there dancing at some kind of festival out in the grass, and he starts moving around. Nobody's with him. Everybody's looking at him like, what's wrong with him? And then all of a sudden, one guy joins him. And all it took was the one guy to join him. And then everybody's in on it, you know, and then the whole crowd is dancing. And I think you started this movement with rapid software testing. the course, and it said, okay, context driven is what we do, but rapid software testing is the class. And how do we, it's been popular for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about the premise of that course, how it relates to, you know, your beliefs and thinking different and what people need to know?
Rapid software testing isn't about typing fast on the keyboard, of course. It's it's mostly about achieving rapidity through deciding not to do things that are not worth doing. But what's behind that, when you think about what does it mean to not do something that isn't worth doing, what's behind that is the willingness to do things differently, to do things that people don't expect, to buck convention, to question convention, and to take responsibility for your own work and your own behavior. So rapid software testing is based on a premise of responsibility, that you take responsibility for your own behavior. We reject what we call pathetic compliance. Pathetic compliance, as opposed to malicious compliance, is when people follow rules just because they don't want to be yelled at. And that's the only reason. It's not because they think the rule is good. It's not because they think that they're doing the right thing. It's just because they don't want trouble, so they go along. And we reject that in rapid software testing. We look for what we call responsible compliance or responsible behavior, which is to say, I do what I do in my work because it's good work. And I believe it, and I can explain that, and I can defend that. And if I come later to believe that the work that I was doing was not good, then I will correct it and I will learn from that and get better. So we teach testing from that perspective. And another element of the class is, in educational theory, it's called constructivism. It's the idea that when I teach you, I'm not giving you knowledge. I can't give you knowledge. What I can do is create an environment where you construct your own knowledge. So what I'm doing as a teacher is I'm being a sort of gardener. I put sunlight, I give you some water, I give you some nutrients, I do a little weeding, and you grow. You teach yourself. I do this with my son. I do this with all my informal students, and I try to do it in the class, although in the class it's a more concentrated experience. We have a set of exercises that we go through which involve trying to trick the students, not in any humiliating way, mind you, although, you know, sometimes people encounter these exercises I do and they feel like I'm trying to humiliate them. And I do everything I can to avoid that impression because I'm really not doing that. What I'm trying to do is create a realistically confusing situation, just like in a difficult testing problem. For instance, you might have to test something and you're not given all the information that you need to test it. And you can't just sit down and cry about that. You got to deal with it. So you deal with it by asking for the information you need, and you might not get the information you need. So you shrug and you say, all right, well, if I'm not going to get that information, then here's what I can do. Here's what I can't do. I can make these assumptions. You know, then you have to make a decision. In some cases, if you don't get certain information, you really should stop. And in other cases, if you don't get the necessary information, then you don't have to stop. You can still be responsible, but you just have to set expectations in a different way. So basically, I teach testing in rapid software testing as embedded in a psychological and social context that if you learn to grapple with that context, you can solve any testing problem. Most other testing classes teach testing as a set of techniques or a set of templates that you fill out. And I reject that. I don't give you templates. I don't, I mean, I do talk about various techniques, sure. But I don't center the class on that. The class is not centered on techniques. It's centered on problems and struggling with problems and working out different ways of solving those problems.
That's so good. I'm looking forward to it. My organization convinced them that we needed to send four of us. So there'll be four of us there in Charlotte at my office coming to it as well.
That's great. Thank you.
And
you made this whole thing happen. I really appreciate that.
Well, it is my pleasure. And I've been looking forward to this for months now. So organizations that don't know it, that don't understand how to get moving into context-driven, and mine would be one that's starting to get in that direction. And I told them the first thing is to learn the fundamentals first and hear it from you. What's your advice for an organization that just doesn't know yet everything about it, but they want to learn it and get started in context-driven?
Well, I told them the first issue is they need to understand how thinkers work in general, no matter testers or developers or philosophers or journalists, any kind of thinker. If you want to have a thinker who works for you, who does thinking stuff, then there are certain conditions and dynamics that you need to understand. It's kind of like if I talk about this thing like I just talked about gardening and all that, and you say, oh, great, I want to do that. So let's see, I'll get some seeds, I'll get some grass seeds, and I'll just sprinkle them all over this office chair here, and then I'll push the office chair up to the computer. Hey, how come it's not doing testing? I put the seeds there. Well, it doesn't quite work that way. You need to understand how it all comes together. You need to understand that this takes time to develop people into testers. You can't just shake them and paint them with tester paint, and then suddenly they're a great tester. It's a process of growing people. And as part of that process of growing people, just like when you're growing real vegetables, sometimes it turns out that someone isn't right for a situation, and they discover as part of their learning that they really don't want to be a tester. It's painful for them to think about testing. Well, okay, so then let them move into some other role.
So true.
And so it's not a straight line matter. A lot of what middle management needs to understand about technical work is that the idea that you go in straight, beautiful lines from point A to point B is a total lie. It's a complete fairy tale, fantasy. I try to explain the gardening metaphor. Another metaphor I find very useful is the sailing metaphor. If you've got a sailboat, you don't just point it in a direction and say, I want to go there, so we're going to point in that direction and just go there. You can do that with a powerboat. But we're not power boats. That's right. The thing. And some of us are more power boaty than others. But for most of us, our psychology, the rhythms of our mind, ebb and flow. Companies keep trying to write down processes and they want to define their process, right? What a bunch of nonsense. The reason why it's a nonsense is nobody tells the truth about their process. Nobody. And people go, oh, I tell the truth about my process. And I go, really? So you're telling me that your process isn't any different when some disrespectful intern shows up at your office and expects you to help them do something that you think they should do for themselves. You think your process for responding to them is exactly the same as when some really charming, attractive person of either gender comes to your office and says, please, can you help me? Don't you think your process is different for the attractive, charming person than for the annoying, disrespectful person? I think it is, but you're not going to write that down in your process document, are you? You're not going to put all the real rules by which actual organizations work in your silly process documents. So these process documents are usually a horrible oversimplification. Now, I know a lot about this because one of the reasons why I became really enthusiastic about process work is when I was writing process documents that I then would not follow. And I think that was a real fork in the road in my career, because I could have done what I think most people do, which is to just shrug and ignore the problem. But instead, I decided, wait, something's wrong here. I wrote this document, and in the document, I wrote these rules, this procedure for my own work. And I'm refusing to follow my own procedure. There's something really deep about this. There's something deeply wrong here, and I need to get to the bottom of it. I cannot ignore it. I cannot just say, oh, I guess I'm crazy, or I must not have discipline. I want to know why I'm not following my own procedures. And I did get to the bottom of it, and I understand now, and I no longer write silly procedures that I expect myself to follow. But I see lots of other people are doing that, and many companies try to operate by these fake procedures. That is the number one thing that people need to understand, is they have to get a new attitude about processes. They need to understand that it's psychology that drives everything. And the funny thing about this is when people argue with me about this, because when they argue with me about it, they're usually proving my point. They're usually demonstrating that they feel bad about what I'm saying. And because they feel bad, they're damn well not going to listen to me. And I'm saying, like, yes, exactly. That is exactly my point. You are not operating based on rationality in business. You're operating based on your fears and your desires. And I'm on a project right now, right today. I'm on a project. And the guy I'm working for is a man I respect very much. And I really want to impress him. And man, does that make me burn the midnight oil. I am pulling out all the stops for this guy. If I didn't respect him, I know from long experience, I wouldn't do the work.
Right.
And I'm being paid a lot of money for this, but I have learned from experience that it doesn't matter how much people pay me. I will still do stuff I'm not paid for that's more fun. My brain will just refuse to do the stuff I'm supposed to do, much to my wife's consternation, because we have to pay the bills. But I'm so glad when I have a project that is financially rewarding, and also it is psychologically fulfilling, because I know that I have to have that psychological fulfillment. Now, I'm an extreme case. I'm an independent because I can't easily get along with other people. I can work with my wife. I can work for her. I'm working for her for 16 years, and she knows how to manage me, and that's good. But very few people can manage me over the long period of time, because I'm a very opinionated guy, and I never want to do anything that doesn't feel right. So it makes you a very annoying person. If that way.
I've speaking of opinions, I visionaries get asked this type of question all the time. So my last question to you is this, and I want to ask you, not knowing yet what we don't know, what do you think is the next big thing for testing? What's coming? What do we not know is coming, or what do you think is coming if you could predict the future?
Okay, here's my prediction. My prediction is that it's 20 years from now, you will still see testers, but there will be a lot fewer people called testers in the world. You will still see them, though. And testers will primarily not come from people who are out of school. It will come from people who have been experienced designers, experienced managers, experienced programmers, and those people will graduate to testing. I think what we will see is that testing will become a high-level specialty, an elite specialty, and that you'll see these testers who might not go by the name tester anymore, but I think they probably will.
Right.
These elite testers will not do all the testing themselves. They will instead be people who organize other people in the team to help them test. So the testing, I believe, in the future will be done mostly by part-time amateurs, organized in the best cases by specialists who really know what they're doing. A similar thing is already the case with, say, performance engineering or security work or usability stuff. Often you have like one usability expert and a bunch of people who kind of help that person or work with that person on usability studies, or you have one person who's a super security expert and then a bunch of other people helping them who kind of know something about security but aren't doing it full time or not, they're not artisans of it. So I think that we're probably moving in that direction. The yes. good news is, in my experience, less than 1 out of 10 testers really wants to be a fantastic tester anyway. I believe there will be work for all of those people who are very passionate about it. And I just want to make the world a safe and happy place and a rewarding place for those really passionate people whose minds wander like mine does, or who are always worried about what if something goes wrong.
Right.
You know, that's why, and when I played soccer in school, when we won the county championship in Grand Isle County, Vermont, back when I was in eighth grade, my team won the county championship, and I was a defenseman. And I chose being a defenseman because I was always worried, hey, what if the ball comes back in our direction? You know, we can't all be trying to get a goal. Some of us have to defend. Right. So I'm a born defender. And I think in testing is really for people who like to play defense. They like to be protective. They like to worry about what if someone surprises us? What if someone flanks us? What if the unexpected happens? That's the way my mind works. And I think a lot of people, not a whole lot of people, but I mean, in an absolute sense, there are a large number of people in the world who understand that kind of thinking and like to do that kind of thinking. And they're content to let other people build and invent new stuff. But we defenders, we like to be vigilant. And we like to express our ingenuity in vigilance, protecting the flock from the wolves, you know. So that's my answer.
Well, thank you so much, James. I can now mark one off my bucket list that I got to interview James Bach. I can say I've done that, and I'm honored to be part of this today with you. And I'm so glad that you took the time to spend this this interview with us to talk about your history. I'm sure there's lots of folks listening that's going to learn things about you that they didn't know. And that was my goal.
Can I say one thing more about my class?
Yes.
One little marketing thing that I want to say, and that is come to my class and I guarantee you one thing for sure. At no point in my class will I insult the intelligence of anybody taking the class. Come to my class. I will treat you like a smart, thoughtful person. You will not be bored. You might be upset at me from time to time, but it won't be because I insulted your intelligence. That is something I believe I can guarantee. Anyway, thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure.
Thanks so much, James. And I agree. I've taken your course online, and I'm looking forward to it. And folks, we have seats out there that are filling up, and we're about full. So get out there, sign up, go to our website, and And make sure that you sign up for the class. It's coming on May the 9th through the 11th. And James, I look forward to seeing you and meeting you again. And we'll see you in Charlotte, North Carolina in a month.
All right. Bye.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to STP Radio. Interested in attending the rapid software testing class in Charlotte? Use promo code RADIO and receive 15% off the registration fee. Learn more by following the links in this post.